Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, I'm with Dan Leiter, head of international at Blackstone Credit Insurance and also global head of liquid credit strategies here. Welcome to the podcast,
Dan. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on your show.
Oh, it's delightful to have you. I have so many questions to ask you. I'm just going to go hit the biggest headline there is.
Great.
Which is the Iran war. It's raging on. The Strait of Hormuz may or may not be closed, and yet the S&P 500 is at all-time high. I can sort of understand that. It's been going on for a while now. The U.S. is a net exporter of oil. But this week, the Korean stock indices, the Japanese stock indices also hit all-time highs. Now, those countries are supposed to be really impacted by the lack of oil coming through the Strait of Hormuz, and yet no one seems to care. So what's going on? Do we no longer care about oil or energy shocks here in this market?
I think we do. There's a few things going on. I mean, first things I would say is that clearly it's a complicated situation in the Middle East. And clearly the markets hadn't priced in going into the year a real conflict like what we've seen.
Yeah, it was a total surprise.
Total surprise. And you've seen that if you look at, in particular, like the price of oil, as you mentioned, up 70, 80% on the year now. So there is an impact. At the same time, it's been a couple of months now. The heat of the tensions seem to have subsided a little bit. And I think the market's pretty good at looking through this and thinking we're going to come to an ultimate conclusion, which is going to be okay. I also think, let's not forget, we started the year in pretty good shape.
We did. You know, so bullish, right?
We started the year with good growth in the U.S., above 2%, Europe, 1.5%. You mentioned Asia. I mean, global economy last year grew over 3%. And a lot of it's driven by this incredible cycle of investment into AI-related infrastructure and AI-related anything, really. And so I think the market's pretty good at seeing through this, and that's really what's happening right now.
I know there is this incredible enthusiasm about AI.
Yeah.
And so that's the next headline I want to hit, because there is a positive element of AI that's boosting growth, but it's also a disruptor.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about something that you handle, which is private credit, right?
Sure.
You're the head of international. And private credit right now is also in the headline, mostly because the questions about AI disruption into software. Do you think that's fair? Because it is like, okay, yes, I think private credit does have a lot of software exposure, but it's not across the board.
Yeah.
And will all software companies go away? Are the headlines justified? I guess I'm asking.
I would say a few things. So first of all, just on the headlines specifically,
yes.
I've been doing this for a long time, two decades now. And I think in my entire career, this is probably the time where I feel the most bid offer between the headlines and what we're actually seeing on the ground in our portfolios, et cetera. We continue to see good growth. Just like I said before, the economy is growing well. You usually don't have big default cycles when there's growth. So that's the first thing I'd say. However, I'd also say that everything that's happening around AI is real, and there is going to be a lot of disruption. The market has focused specifically on software right now. I would say very concretely, not all software is created equal. You were asking, is all software going to go bust? No, absolutely not. There are some software companies that are providing services that are deeply embedded, like systems of record. And then there are some software companies that kind of provide an overlay of analytics, for example, or just content creation, where the moats aren't as strong. By the way, it doesn't mean that all those companies will have problems either. It just means that they will have to adapt probably more aggressively than some of the rest of the space. But I think taking a step back for a moment, at Blackstone, we've been so focused on AI. We've been a leader in digital infrastructure, whether it's data centers, chips, everything around power, actually really driving this extraordinary boom that, yeah, we've been really focused on this theme for a long time. So, you know, you look at our investment committee memos, forget just software. For over a year, we have entire sections dedicated to AI scorecards. You know, how is the business going to be impacted? And I think what's going to be interesting is ultimately this disruption will be far, far broader than software. Professional services, think about accounting, taxes, think about healthcare. A lot of it will be really great.
Absolutely.
A lot of very positive outcomes too. But it's not going to just be specific to software. And I think the headlines have been so narrow, actually. I think we'll see some changes in that as it becomes more clear, you know, what AI is actually able to disrupt and where the moats are bigger than we expect.
But one area that the headlines have impacted private credit is all these non-traded BDCs. BCRED, for one, you guys have the biggest non-traded BDC for private credit in the world. You guys sort of pioneered this kind of asset, this fund that attracts sort of the what we call the affluent or the wealth channel. And it's been so popular that I remember when it first came to be, the amount of capital you attracted, it reshaped private credit. It gave you guys so much firepower, made you go for deals that people never envisioned this asset class going after. But now we're seeing some withdrawal. And what I think was really interesting is that Blackstone has opted to honor all the withdrawal requests. Other firms, your peers, have not. So can we discuss what's going on right now and what your sense of what's happening with these non-traded BDCs?
Well, first, I just come back to what I said before, which is fundamentally, we're not seeing a big stress, okay, in our portfolio companies. That doesn't mean that there won't be idiosyncratic defaults here and there, that this is credit. That's always the case. But what something like our perpetual credit strategies really offer is access to private credit investments. And that's an alternative to investing in liquid credit. So if you think about what all these strategies are trying to do deep down, it's just create this premium and deliver this premium performance to our customers. And in the case of our perpetual vehicles, a lot of those customers end up being retail investors. Mm-hmm. I think they have been more focused to some extent on the headlines because it's a little harder for our retail investors to really understand some of the dynamics in the portfolios that we own. It's interesting because if you contrast this with our institutional investors, our institutional flows at Blackstone have been extraordinarily strong.
Yeah, I hear that. The institutional,
yeah, we just had earnings, right?
I talk to you guys and I talk to others and they tell me the institutional investors are still deploying and still allocating.
I'd say actually somewhat excited that spreads are widening a little bit. But if you just think about these vehicles, really what we're delivering is access to premium through private investments that otherwise individual investors couldn't access. And historically, that premium's been for non-investment grade private credit, which is the traditional market, direct lending, most of what's in these vehicles. It's been about 200 basis points. So let's contrast that a little bit with the headlines, because one thing that has surprised me is this extraordinary focus on we're going to have private credit specific issues.
Yeah.
You know, there's this notion that there's something inherently riskier about private credit than the comparable leveraged loan, liquid credit, BSL market, I think is very misplaced. If you look at what we're doing in private credit, first of all, we start with 200 basis points more spread. That's a lot.
Just
basic numbers. Even if we assume much lower recoveries this time around for credit broadly, leveraged finance broadly, than in the past, say 50% recovery. You could default 4% more in the private credit portfolios and only lose 2%. And that would basically get you to the liquid credit return. And that's why, just anecdotally, private credit has continued to, for two decades, deliver excess return to liquid credit, because really we're not doing such different things. I mean, the main structural feature that's actually better than liquid credit in my mind, especially these days, is that when we're dealing directly with companies, not only do we have a little more access to the diligence, but our structural protections in the documents are better. And if you actually look at what's happening especially in the U.S. in the leveraged loan market, documents have weakened a lot. LMEs, to the extent you're following what's happening with distressed exchanges, et cetera, it's quite prevalent in the U.S. So I think that not only will private credit default rates remain in line or even lower than the broadly syndicated market, I think recoveries will be higher in private credit as well.
But do you think the retail investors understood what they were getting into? Some people have said that instead of calling these semi-liquid, they should have been called semi-illiquid. They've been told 5%, but do they really understand? Have you heard from your advisors that investors are complaining about being capped? Or is it something that they're like, okay, I'm just going to put this money in, see what I get. I may get 5, I might get more.
I am not aware of any complaints, actually. I would go even further and say that in our disclosures, in the first page of the prospectus, there are multiple phrases in bold around this specific risk. So I think it's quite unlikely that investors invested in this and really had no idea that this could potentially happen. You mentioned the point, we did actually honor the full redemption last quarter in any of the vehicles that were impacted. But I think the way I like to describe this to people is to say, okay, if you want to invest in private markets, historically, you had these drawdown vehicles, which, by the way, individual investors couldn't really invest in. Mm-hmm. So you had these drawdown vehicles. Then these vehicles came along. And what's interesting in the drawdown vehicles, your source of liquidity is only when you get repayment eventually. So what's nice about these vehicles is Well, for most states of the world, you benefit from investing in private credit. You get the spread premium we talked about. And in most states of the world, you actually get the liquidity. And in some states of the world, you won't get full liquidity right away, but the liquidity profile is still way better than it was for or is for drawdown funds. So if liquidity is something you value and you want to invest in private credit, this is a great way to do it. And even some of our competitors who did institute some of the caps the last quarter, most of the clients in those vehicles that redeemed end up getting about half their money back,
right?
So I think there's been so much headlines around this, but I think when we look back in just a few months' time, I don't think it will take that long. Everyone will see that actually the return profile in private credit remains really attractive, especially versus liquid credit, if that's your main comparison, and that these vehicles are healthy. And it's not just about Blackstone. I think the whole market actually, yes, there will be differentiation. Obviously, we have a franchise where we have enormous scale. We benefit a lot from the insights across the firm, the data points we get also from private equity and real estate and our colleagues everywhere. And we're using their knowledge for a lot of the analysis we do. For example, for software, it's a good example. But we also have a team that if there are problem credits, we have 125 people in our office of the CIO asset managing. So I think big picture, there will definitely be a differentiation. But I think broadly speaking, the market's very healthy.
Well, so why do it? Because some people say that the 5% cap is a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
So why honor every request?
Well,
what was the thought process behind
that? Well, we took the view that it was the right thing to do at the time. You know, these are our clients. We have ample liquidity. So it was not an issue to honor the redemption. And we thought it was the right thing to do. But, you know, in any of these decisions, you kind of assess them when they come about. And I can't predict the future, but what I can tell you is that our competitors did the same thing.
Yes,
they assessed what they thought was right for their vehicles.
And some did and some didn't.
Some did, some didn't. You know, they also have different liquidity profiles. They have different considerations. We felt very comfortable with what we did and we thought it was the right decision.
And let's move on to another headline that's been hitting, which is Medallia, which is a private credit loan to a software company that has gone troubled.
Yes.
There is now some chatter that you might even take the keys. So is this a sign of trouble? Is this a canary in the coal mine? Or these are risk assets and they should be some defaults. You don't get these kind of double-digit returns to take zero risk. Let's say you on...
I would say a few things. First, you're absolutely right. You know, their defaults have been actually quite low. Last year, defaults came down versus 2024 even. I can't comment on too much of the specifics of Medallia, but what I would just say is this credit was a troubled credit well before anyone was talking about software, and it's not related to AI. And it's also not credit related to any of the private credit news recently. This was a massive LBO with the sponsors having contributed $5+ billion at the time, and the execution was poor. So yeah, there are going to be some defaults in any portfolio, and we'll work that one out as best we can.
Yeah, so tell me about that process, because I do think the process for default, how to deal with a default and working it out is different for private credit. So what is your process?
Well, I didn't mention it before, but I actually think that that's another really strong advantage of private credit, actually, because if you think about when we work out liquid credit exposures, you're usually in a lender group, which is not the original lender group.
And so big. And
super fragmented, 80-20 plus. Everyone's entered at different prices. Everyone has different incentives as a consequence. It's quite complicated, and that's bad for restructuring outcomes. Another driver of ultimate recovery is going to be around, you know, how joined up are the lenders. That's another big advantage of private credit, because when we finance through private credit, through direct lending, our intention is to hold to maturity. And it's not just us. Mm-hmm. In general, the market, that's how we act. So if we're a sole lender, this is particularly simple. If we have multiple lenders, again, it's usually less than a handful. So when you have a situation that is problematic, generally speaking, you can drive much better outcomes. And I think, again, that's another determinant of ultimately what will be higher recovery in private credit markets.
Well, you've been very indulgent with me answering all my headline questions that I wanted to ask from you. But now I'd like to think a little bit more about your expertise, because you're a head of international. Where regions are you most excited about right now? Because we've talked in the past about Asia. There's growth there, but there isn't as much private equity and private credit there. What are you seeing in Asia?
Well, big picture, the private credit market has been changing dramatically. And what I mean by that is, if you just go back two decades, post-financial crisis, when it really started to emerge, it was because the banks were much more constrained in what they could do. And private credit was kind of doing opportunistic rescue financing. Yeah. It was pretty distressed. And from there, it migrated into, call it a more, I don't want to say vanilla, but, you know, standard direct lending market that was really competing with broadly syndicated loans. And the reasons were simple. The borrowers saw the benefits of private credit, like speed, certainty, knowing who their lenders actually are over time, and some more flexible financings, too.
And the banks are so dominant in Asia.
Sorry?
The banks are so dominant.
Well, so basically, fast forward, what's happened is this entire market has emerged in the U.S. first and foremost, has made its way to Europe. It's expanded massively in scope, actually, because historically it was just non-investment grade. And I'd say the biggest topic in general across our whole franchise
is
private investment grade now. But what does that mean? Where does it leave us for international? Well, first of all, I'd say international is a massive growth vector. One of the reasons I'm so excited about my role at Blackstone is that I can help drive our expansion internationally. And Europe's a bit ahead of Asia for sure, but Asia's coming. We say Europe. It's a lot of different countries.
Right.
We say Asia, it's even
that's
more fragmented.
Even more,
right,
and point. Even more different.
Doing business doing a private credit transaction, we just did a deal in Japan. Very different from doing India. It's very different from doing
Australia
or Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. So they're all their own markets and they're all at different stages. Australia, for example, is actually very advanced. Mm-hmm. Australia, in some aspects of whether it's private investment grade or non-investment grade, is ahead of many European countries.
What outside of Australia, what other country are you most excited about growth-wise?
I think Japan's going to be really interesting. Yeah,
even with all their banks.
Yeah, well, I think what's happening.
Such a strong time.
Well, I can give you some anecdotes actually because you mentioned the banks. Mm-hmm. We did a transaction with SMBC, which is one of the premier banks in Japan. We did a SRT transaction, which is where we provide first loss protection to a bank, and that's usually on core portfolios that they
usually
have.
Usually European. Sometimes you see in.
Yeah.
In US,
so the fact we did that on a portfolio of project finance loans, so call it infrastructure assets that SMBC had. And I think it's an important anecdote, actually, because it shows you that even the Japanese banks are focused on their balance sheet and optimization of capital, et cetera. This has been a huge theme. You know, the bank deleveraging and just capital optimization overall is actually more prevalent outside of the U.S. now than it is in the U.S.
And so where are you flying to most? Not for the fundraising, but where are you flying to grow your business? I mean, I'm sort of jealous of your, like, what your frequent flyer mile must be.
Yeah, well, there's a cost to all that. they can take a toll, too, sometimes. Well, I'm about to head to Munich after this, actually. So I'm very excited about our European franchise, actually.
Well.
I have done already three trips to Asia this year, so that's been a big focus. But it comes back to a little bit what I was saying on the, if you think about the two big components that we're working on is obviously local origination internationally. So doing more origination in the UK of UK assets, German assets, et cetera, across all of Europe, the same for Australia and Japan, as I mentioned. And then there's all the client side. And the client side is really exciting because just like the structure of the market is a little bit more nascent in internationally, the same applies by definition almost to our client side. So if you look at insurers' balance sheets, for example, so insurers in the U.S. are pretty penetrated now in private credit. There's still a lot of room to grow, but they've got, call it a third of their balance sheet in private credit. And then you look at Europe, it's like 10 to 15%, and APAC is more like 5%. And again, each country is a bit different. But when I go on these trips, there's just so much upside to develop these relationships and really broaden our franchise. We struck our first big insurance partnership last year in the UK with LNG. Phenomenal partner of ours. Yeah.
Because you guys are Blackstone Credit and Insurance, right?
Yeah.
And that happened, I think, about 4 years ago. So I want to hear about how that's been coming along. And you guys do insurance a little bit different. A lot of your peers have bought an insurance company or have like an in-house insurance firm. But you guys don't. So explain a little bit the thought process and how the melding of credit and insurance come along and how you guys are different.
Sure. So we are very different in that respect because, as you say, we don't own an insurer. And we're one of the very few large players in the market that decided that model was the right model. Most participants have gone out and bought an insurance company. And there's been, even in the UK, multiple instances of that last
year.
And
you just produce credit products and feed the insurance beast, right?
We didn't do that for two big reasons, I would say. First, we wanted to stay true to our DNA as an asset manager and stay balance sheet light. And Second, and very importantly, you know, we already have a lot of insurance clients. We didn't want to compete with those insurance clients in their core market of writing, for example, life insurance policies, their liability side. We wanted to make sure we could service them on the asset side. We do a ton for insurance clients. So from asset allocation, we help them rotate portfolios. We help them with structuring, asset management. It goes on and on, reporting. So we have 100+ people on this. So we really thought this was the right model for us. Now, what I would say is it's part of the reason we're one of the few big players to have chosen this model is it takes a lot of effort to get going.
Yeah, I can imagine.
We built this business client by client by client. It's now a $280 billion AUM business. So it's a massive business. One of the fastest growing segments for us grew 18% last year.
Oh, wow. That's big.
And again, most of the market was established, I would say, with U.S. clients, but we're expanding to Europe. That's where LNG comes in. We've struck a bunch of other U.K. partnerships, which were not publicly or broadly announced, same in across Europe and even in Asia. So yeah, our platform is very different. We're basically open architecture. So when we sign up with an insurance client, they plug into what they're most interested in. We've mentioned private investment grade, for example.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Isn't one of the reasons like big drivers for private investment grade is because insurance firms like
they're mostly investment grade,
and that's the better one. And then you have the benefit that it like lends to the broader economy, right? Not just to for LBO loans,
100%.
Which is what people think of private credit as direct lending. It's really moved away from that now.
100%.
And I think the growth seems to be in the investment grade. So tell me about what's your strategy for investment grade? What have you done and what are you guys excited
about? Sure. I mean, like I was saying before, you know, once the private credit aperture expanded to financing the real economy, across infrastructure, asset-based credit, more broadly, can include real estate, can include transportation, et cetera,
music.
Et cetera. Yeah, exactly. We've been the big there too. It has completely changed kind of the dialogue and our ability to do things with a much broader set of clients, especially insurance clients, because insurance clients, predominantly their balance sheets are invested in investment grade. And so that's been huge for us. And when I say open architecture, that just means, for example, let's say we have some insurance clients that say, okay, we love what you're doing in infrastructure. We just want to do infrastructure with you. And then we have some clients that say, you know, we've done now infrastructure with you. Actually, we love what we're doing. Can we do everything? And we have much broader mandates. So that's obviously what we love expanding with our clients as we get them on.
And then we're expecting some regulatory changes, especially in Europe for insurance firms, right? So how does that, is that going to touch both IG investment grade private credit, or is it just for sort of the more like what we used to call junk bonds or leveraged loans, or you know the sub what would be sub investment grade if there was such a thing?
No,
if they were rated.
So the biggest challenge with Europe on under Solvency II, so some of the regime that most of the European insurers are under, has been around securitization. Actually, so post financial crisis, the securitization markets really got constrained in their ability to grow and flourish, I'd say, because of regulation that has made it almost impossible for insurance companies, if they have a standard model. So there are different models they can have, but a lot of them have a standard model to invest in the space. Mm-hmm. CLOs is a good example, for example, right? And some of that is changing very materially early next year. So just for context, since I mentioned CLOs, the senior part of the capital structure, AAA CLOs, are going to become more than 70% more efficient than they've been.
And there's such a big premium for this kind of, because of this regulatory limitations and also the complexity factor.
That's right. So there's going to be, it could have a big impact actually on certain segments of the market, especially senior parts of securitizations, and hopefully will help the entire securitization market grow. I think securitization market is a well-functioning market for securitization is actually great for the economy. Yeah, I've been delighted to see some of those changes starting, well, hopefully taking place in the near term, within the next year.
And then also, let's go back to like what we were talking about in the very beginning with AI. It is the data centers, and there's high-yield bonds now, there's private credit, IG, also sub-investment grade. Is there enough funding for all the CapEx need, and how does Blackstone play into this?
This is a very interesting point, because the reason, again, why is private investment grade actually interesting? It's for a similar reason that why private credit in the first place was direct lending is interesting, is because of the spread pickup. So if you think about the spread pickup in non-investment grade, it's been about 200 basis points. The interesting thing about investment grade is it's also been around
about
200 basis points, which is a massive premium.
Massive premium, right? For IG.
It's a multiple of IG spreads, right? So so why is that happening, to your point? Well, because there is such a demand supply imbalance of capital, actually. If you think about the hyperscalers this year, they're going to, 3 years ago, their spend was, call it sub $300 billion. Then last year, people were saying, wow, they're spending $400 billion. They're projected to spend like $700 billion this year. These numbers are staggering. And it's across everything around AI. You know, it's, I would tell you the big, huge themes we're seeing is data and data centers, which Blackstone has also been very involved in from the very start. You know, we own QTS, we own AirTrunk in Asia. So it's an ecosystem we know really well. Chip financing and chips more broadly, and power. These are the themes.
Right, you need power to
fuel power. You know, we have projections now saying that electricity demand is going to be something in the context of 40% more in 10 years in the U.S. I mean, this is extraordinary. You know, the grid's not ready. The amount of spend necessary, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's in Europe, whether it's in Asia, is enormous. And so much of this actually can be done in investment grade because you're dealing with really high-quality counterparties. You're dealing with really stable cash flows. And so if you look at some of the largest financings we've done over the last year, they've been around that theme. And that's, again, been such a big spread pickup for insurance clients. And by the way, it's not just insurance clients.
Right.
So there are other clients who like private investment grade too, you know?
Right.
So we have pension clients. We have other many clients who want this extra premium in investment grade.
But is Europe going to be left behind? Because sometimes I don't see the same excitement for AI spending. AI, you know, there's a social construct of AI, but I'm talking about the growth that AI will give, the CapEx spend. I don't see it as much in Europe, but you are so much closer to it. Where is Europe in getting on board with the AI boom?
It's definitely not as advanced. And I am optimistic that Europe is actually going to make big investments around this. I look at even our pipeline, which is very centered around utilities and some of the power infrastructure I was talking about. And there's obviously also a growing pipeline around data centers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But Europe is behind for sure.
Yes.
I think part of it is the attitude in the U.S. Europe is often very much focused first and foremost on regulation, making sure that things are done in a way that they think is responsible, I'd say. So, you know, this is, I'm not trying to blame one way or the other or say there's a right approach here, but I think just objectively speaking, the U.S. on this particular theme is far ahead.
Yes. So if you're looking at Europe, what countries do you think is the more advanced vis-a-vis other? What areas do you think, okay, they're a little bit more forward, this is where it's going to happen first? Is it France?
Well, I think actually the U.K. is trying. We have some big projects here, and we've seen things in Ireland, actually. Yeah. Ireland in general has been very open, not just in this area, but in many ways. And you mentioned France, and I think all of the countries will get there, really. You know, I don't think anyone's going to be completely left behind.
But it might take a little longer.
But it will take a little bit longer.
So far, everything is sort of, you got a big job and a lot of exciting things, but you're a credit guy, so that means you have worries. So name me your biggest worry, because lots of growth in Asia, U.S., and also in Europe. Private credit is doing okay. There's more room to expand in IG. Liquid credit is also doing well, although the spreads might be a little too tight. But what are you worried about?
I would say, going back to the beginning of the conversation somewhat, AI disruption is real, and it's very hard to predict where things are going to be in 3 years' time. Think about 3 years ago.
Even six months ago,
this conversation, right?
Yes.
Right? It is almost inconceivable to have at least that part of the conversation. So I think there's going to be a lot of change, and we have to be very conscious of that and very focused. But again, you know, the good thing is credit is a defensive asset class. You know, our starting LTVs are really low, whether it's in software or the rest of the book. And so we have a lot of downside protection. At the same time, you know, there are clearly going to be some things that don't go as anyone expects. And so, you know, that sometimes keeps me up at night. The other thing I would just say around that, in general, as a person, I always feel like when it comes to change, you have different things you can do. You know, you can resist change. That's usually a pretty bad idea. You kind of accept change and then you go with the flow, or you can embrace change. I think we're going into a world in which embracing change is very, very important. Again, one of the reasons I was so excited about coming to Blackstone, because I feel like this is an extremely entrepreneurial space where we are constantly trying to do things differently and make sure we're on our toes.
You're laying me up for a question that I've been very curious about you personally, which is that lots of people, you came from investment banking. Lots of people come from investment banking to the buy side, but maybe junior staff, the analysts, maybe the associate comes over. You came in as a very senior role. You had a career in investment banking to go come to the switch to the buy side for a very different role. How did they convince you to do that? And what has that been like?
Yeah. So I was at Morgan Stanley for 18 years.
Right?
That was my whole career prior to Blackstone. I joined Blackstone about 2 years ago. And it was an extraordinary experience at Morgan Stanley. You know, I had no regrets when I was leaving. I'm the type of person, just naturally, I'm a very curious person. Mm-hmm. I love doing new things. Mm-hmm. I was there 18 years, but I did a lot of different roles from structuring to strategy to trading, helped build financing business, et cetera. And I'm a little paranoid about being bored in life, honestly.
Okay.
And so when this opportunity came along, I said, wow, it's an incredible organization. Mm-hmm. I had had the pleasure of dealing with Blackstone when I was at Morgan Stanley and, you know, in the real estate team and the tac ops team and so many different groups, including credit, obviously. I knew that was going to be good. And then the role itself seemed so interesting. You know,
this is
where the market,
the whole world.
Yeah, this is where the market's going. I was like, well, I'm never going to be bored. Okay. And I know the people are great. And so for me, it was a fairly natural transition, actually. And yeah, it's been amazing.
What was the biggest adjustment that you didn't expect? Because it is a different world to be in a bank and being in an asset manager.
Yeah, you know, I loved a few things, actually. Mm-hmm. I did not expect it to be culturally as collaborative as it is. You know, just today, I've been on calls with our colleagues in on the private equity side, with our real estate colleagues as well, working on deals together.
Yeah.
And then within credit insurance, you know, we have all these different products, but everyone works very, very closely together. It's a very open culture. I wasn't somehow buy side. I expected a little bit more siloed, but I think this is great.
And if you're going to tell a junior analyst or an associate coming over, which they ought to do, any word of advice? Hey, banker, when you come over to bank side.
You know what also has been great here around that point? I've always said that the way to really, I feel very fortunate for the career I've had. And part of the reason I say that is because I've always loved what I do. It's like, it's a hobby, you know?
Right.
And I feel like to succeed, you really need to care about what you're doing. And one thing that has been remarkable about working at Blackstone, and I think it shines through culturally, is people really care about what they're doing. You know, you go the extra mile, you get on that plane to see the client, or, you know, you stay the extra few hours at night to get something done. I see that everywhere. And I think to succeed at Blackstone, that level of care really is very important.
Well, you heard it here. If you want to succeed in buy side, care about it.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation. I really enjoyed having you.
Great. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us. And do follow us at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Lisa Lee.